Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael Pina of SB Nation. Michael, we have a lot to get to today, including a really fascinating piece that you put up today on Bam Adebayo, an aspiring first-time All-Star. And I do think we should look around the league and see which other first-time All-Stars might be able to kind of get into that Chicago midseason showcase that's coming up in the not-too-distant future, and voting will be opening soon. But before we do that, we had a showcase game on Wednesday up in Toronto. The Raptors welcomed back Kawhi Leonard for the first time. It was ring night. They gave him his ring, as gaudy and audacious as you might expect it to be. Apparently, he had it sized and fitted for his middle finger so that, you know, symbolically he can tell everybody what they can do with themselves. And the Clippers went in there and just took the game. I mean, it was a blowout. Big second half run, kind of put it away. Everybody was relaxed and, kind of chilling down the stretch of that game. So I'm curious, there was a lot of buildup, massive media presence there in Toronto. Was it a letdown of a game for you, Michael? Did it kind of play to expectations? What did that game tell you about Kawhi Leonard, about the Clippers, or about the Raptors?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it would be a teensy-weensy bit more competitive, probably. That the Raptors did not have Fred VanVleet, and he's been one of their best players this season, so I think that hurt them a little. But I thought it was kind of a showcase, as you said, for the Clippers, Kawhi and PG. They haven't had a ton of time together on the floor so far this season. They're two superstars. They're two of the 10 best players in the world when healthy, and, you know, last night, we saw a lot of situations where they were playing off of each other in ways that not a lot of duos can do in the league. So just real quick, there was one example that really stood out to me that was pretty subtle. But, you know, Paul George had the ball at the top of the key, and Kawhi Leonard was flanking him on the right. And now, typically, you know, the Kawhi's man, if Kawhi was not Kawhi, would be really in a help position, near the elbow, not allowing Paul George to drive to the basket. Because it was Kawhi, this player was about, you know, he should have been closer to Kawhi. He was not. He was in a normal help position. So PG just threw Kawhi the ball. Kawhi put it on the floor. This poor defender, I think it was Norm Powell off the top of my head, tried to close out, drew a foul. It's just like the subtle things that these guys do. They have superstar gravity. They're incredible. They're barely on the cusp of, they barely figured out anything about one another so far. And, you know, I think that they have so much more to improve upon, and we've already seen them be terrific together.
Right. I think the one thing that they do know about themselves, though, is that they're really good. I mean, there's a lot of swagger with this Clippers group. You know what I mean?
For
and
sure.
I actually kind of thought this game, I mean, pardon the phrase, I think it was like a swag off, right? Like you have the Raptors going in there trying to show what a great organization they are, but also, you know, trying to show how they've moved on from Kawhi Leonard and, you know, chuckling with him before the game and all these hugs and daps and everything. And then you've got the Clippers who are like, all right, well, we're the new kids on the block. We want to show you what we're capable of doing. And then they got scoring from basically everybody. That's been the story for the Clippers. I mean, that four-headed monster, like they like to call it, you know, throwing in Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell. All those guys are kind of contributing in different ways in that game. And, you know, their overall talent kind of won out. But you mentioned Fred VanVleet off the top. You do not want to go to a swag off without Fred VanVleet. I think that's a major takeaway from this game, right? Because to me, Toronto looked kind of a little bit like a shell of themselves, even though Lowry was out there and even though Pascal played okay. I just thought that, you know, in that showcase moment, maybe they weren't quite ready for it. They looked a little bit more like a cute story team than they looked like an aspiring contender who could somehow crash the party and upset Milwaukee, if that makes sense. Now, from the Clippers side, I do think it's important here. I'm seeing a little trend. You know, they say like three data points is a trend, right? We have opening night where they take down the Lakers head-to-head against LeBron in a very impressive win without Paul George. We have the showdown between Paul George and Russell Westbrook, you know, former teammates in Los Angeles, where they double-team Harden late in the game. They have this frantic comeback. They use their coma lineup, like I called it, you know, not quite the death lineup. And then they force Westbrook to chuck a three and brick it. They win that showcase game. And then now they stomp Toronto.
What about the Celtics?
Okay, all right. Come on. Pump the brakes here a little bit. You're not in the top-tier showdown conversation quite yet if you're the Boston Celtics. But they did win that one, too. I mean, it was close. You know, the one game that they didn't win, of course, was or really the two against Milwaukee. One of them, Kawhi Leonard, you know, wasn't on the court. The other one, they just didn't show up in Milwaukee. So it's not like they're spotless in these big moments, but I do see a little bit of a trend here where they're able to raise their game maybe to a level that is better than their record indicates, if that makes sense. And their record is good, but the way they've played in a couple of these games, they look great.
Yeah, 19-7. I mean, they're 12-3 since Paul George came back, which is pretty significant. Just go back to load management, the fact that Kawhi Leonard doesn't really take the regular season too seriously. So why should I analyzing the team? But I look at this team. The offense is 10th in the league. It's the coma lineup, as you mentioned, has struggled offensively, but only played 35 minutes. So I just see a lot of potential here and a lot of growth in the ceiling on the different lineups that they can play. I mean, last night we saw, you mentioned, you know, Kyle Lowry dapping Kawhi up pregame. And then it's like Kawhi Leonard's guarding him and Lowry goes 1-for-8. And they can throw Mo Harkless on Pascal, have PG just kind of being his free safety self, roaming around, wreaking havoc, and having Kawhi lock down the heart and soul of the team. And it's just the defense on this of this Clippers team. Like, what I want to see is for them to get somehow Andre Iguodala, and then everyone can just ask Andre Iguodala if the Clippers defense is better than the Warriors defense, like in every single road game. That's like what I'm really banking on and hoping happens.
Well, you know, Michael, this is holiday party season. I'm sure people are going to be going to a lot of holiday parties here over the next week or two. If you really want to win the basketball argument at your holiday party or the conversation, you want to impress everybody else, do exactly what Michael did and bring up Mo Harkless. Everyone's going to be raving about, oh, Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. And you can just pipe it and say, and they have Mo Harkless too. Wow, isn't that just unfair versatility and length? But it's also true. It's a great point that you're making. I'm curious, you mentioned how Kawhi doesn't really care about the regular season. Are we seeing a tortoise and a hare thing develop here between the Lakers and the Clippers? Like, if you're the Clippers, is the Lakers going for like 70 wins and going all out and like trying to, you know, just smoke teams night after night and taking the regular season really seriously? Is that falling into your hands? Like, is that what you want to see the Lakers doing?
Maybe. I mean, the Lakers have had a pretty, well, actually, I was about to say that the Lakers have had a soft schedule, but they've actually like pummeled the tough teams here in December, so I can't really even say that anymore. Maybe. I mean, I think both these teams are just on a collision course right now for the Western Conference Finals, or at least I hope that that's what happens. It's really funny about the Clippers is like Doc Rivers still plays, even in games where Kawhi and PG are healthy and in the starting lineup, there's still segments of the game where neither guy is on the court, which I think is really interesting. And, you know, there are lineups where the Lakers don't have AD and LeBron on the court, but I just don't think it's necessarily the same thing. So both teams are really impressive on both ends so far, and we're going to see, hopefully in the playoffs, hopefully down the stretch of the regular season even, situations where their coaching staffs are trying to, you know, increase the chemistry and play these guys more and more together. So that'll be interesting to see, and it just kind of speaks to what more they have to do or what more they have to show, I think, on both sides of the ball.
Yeah, it's just a really interesting contrast where you've got the Lakers. We would say the chemistry between Anthony Davis and LeBron is basically a 10 out of 10, right? And as you mentioned with Paul George and Kawhi, they're not there yet. Now on the rest side or the load management and minutes side, we could probably say, okay, well, the Clippers are taking this at like a 9 or a 10 in terms of their caution level and developing it slowly, whereas the Lakers just don't seem to care about it at all. So it's two different approaches. Just something to track here throughout the regular season, you know, if there's any bumps and bruises that kind of accumulate. But, you know, really, we're going to want to, you know, isolate on these variables if they do meet in the playoffs, who's fresher, who looks like they've played together longer, you know, who's able to kind of anticipate each other's movements among those superstar duos. I think it's just something to keep an eye on. All right, one last super crucial, important question to ask you, Michael, about the whole ring night thing. Is getting the ring sized for your middle finger actually a cool thing to do, or was that kind of lame from Kawhi? I need your verdict.
well, when you are...
Because he said they have a little graphic on the inside of it, right? It's right. Sort of like the emoji flipping finger off. So clearly he's trying to send a message to the haters, maybe. I don't know how, you know,
who is
I'm
even,
not sure exactly who the haters
yeah,
are.
Yeah, who's even hating Kawhi Leonard? I don't really know what he's talking about there. I mean,
I definitely was last year, and I kind of am with this question right now. I can't lie. but is it cool or not?
I think it's cool because he already has a ring. Doesn't he have two rings? Does he have two rings or one ring?
This is his second ring, yep.
Okay.
If his 2014 ring was sized for his ring finger, and then now he's sizing the second one for his middle finger, he can then, you know, pose with the two rings side by side in a New Balance ad together, I guess is where we're going, right?
Yeah, I think it's fine. I'm cool with it. I still don't really understand the purpose because, you know, beyond wanting to wear them both at the same time on the same hand, I guess, but... Yeah, I don't really know who would have any beef with Kawhi leaving and wanting to go home. And I think, you know, winning the title and hitting the shots that he hit in the playoffs and the fact that the Raptors fans were no one was booing. I guess that speaks to how polite they are, but also, like, who's criticizing him? Who's doubting him? Like, this trend with superstar players thinking that the world is against them is pretty comical.
Well, you had to go there with the polite talk because I just want to point out, look, I haven't forgotten what happened when Kevin Durant got injured up there in Toronto, okay? Mm. I tried my best to give the Raptors fans in the building a pass at that moment because, look, they had never been in that situation before. There is a natural human instinct when, you know, things go your way and someone's going away on a breakaway dunk that, you know, you're going to get excited about it. But I thought the Raptors players were very polite in that moment after KD got injured. But look, it's very easy to look polite on TV when you have months to prepare for Kawhi Leonard's return. It's a lot more difficult to stay polite when the tensions are high in that finals environment. And they were not polite to Kevin Durant when that happened. So I haven't forgotten, and I'm not giving them polite credit whatsoever on the Kawhi Leonard thing. Here's the thing. I think if I was doing the rings, Michael, I think I would have done one for my right hand ring finger. The second one would be for my left hand ring finger because I would want to wear them together and sort of do like the Juvenile dance, you know, the rapper Juvenile, where he used to kind of have like his two hands as a fist and then just kind of like bringing his hands up and down in front of him together. I think I would want to have...
Throw those bows. Yeah,
yeah. I would want to... Yeah, exactly. I'd want to throw the bows with balance. I would want to have, you know, a big ring on each hand. I wouldn't want to be too overloaded one direction. But there is that famous picture of Michael Jordan, remember, with all six of his rings. I think he put them onto one hand, right? And so we know Kawhi loves Mike. So maybe this is like his homage to Mike, right? It's like he's going to be collecting his rings here all on his giant fingers, and he could take a similar picture and not post it on Instagram or wherever else because he doesn't have those accounts. All right, enough about Kawhi Leonard. Let's hop to, I would... You know, safely call him one of the big breakout players of this early season. That's Miami Heat forward, center, guard, wing, whatever else you want to call him, Bam Adebayo. And Michael, you wrote a piece on him that published on Thursday. I encourage everyone to check it out. There's a lot of themes going on in that piece, but I think the major one is the one that I kind of just hinted at, which is the positional versatility and the skill versatility. And you opened with the scene where Eric Spoelstra is essentially telling Bam, hey, it's your job to guard Russell Westbrook tonight. You know, Westbrook got his numbers, but, you know, you kind of explored how did this work for Miami? Why would they go to it? And sort of what does it even mean for him as he kind of goes forward into his career? You know, tell us why you chose that particular moment to kind of highlight Bam. And then just give me, like, you know, a solid 2 minutes of Bam gushing, because I feel like you maybe have a half an hour of it in you.
Sure, yeah. Thanks, Ben. So I sat down with Bam for a good while, and I mean, before I interviewed him, I watched, you know, a ton of tape. I watched a ton of Heat games, and one right before I interviewed him was against the Houston Rockets, and I noticed from the jump, it was their second game against the Rockets this season. And in the first game, you know, he's guarding PJ Tucker. He's hanging out in the corner, usually helping off PJ, but doing things that normal big men defenders have to do when they play the Rockets. And then in the second encounter, you know, he's like up in Russell Westbrook from the opening tip. And I was like, what is happening here? So one of the first things that I decided to talk to him about was that game, and like, what the hell happened? Like, how did you find out you were guarding Westbrook? Have you ever defended anyone like that before? What did the Heat tell you in preparation? Did they give you any reason or rationale for why you were going to defend one of the most bloodthirsty attack dogs in NBA history, who's a point guard? And you're, you know, this 6'9", 6'10", guy who entered the league 250 pounds, guy who entered the league is basically like, you know, I compare him to Clint Capella. He could have been a Clint Capella, could have been a rim runner, a screen and roll guy, someone who's strictly doing what we all wanted Dwight Howard to do for most of his career, that type of big man role, which is what a lot of guys get kind of boxed into. And Bam is basically like bursting out of that box, and this is the Miami Heat allowing him to do that. And we talk a lot about guys who can switch 1 through 5, and when you really break it down, there aren't a lot. Like, that's very hyperbolic, in my opinion. I don't think there's a lot of guys who can actually switch.
It's an imprecise term, right? Because, okay, if you do switch onto a point guard and you can kind of contain him and give him a little space and not get burned going to the basket, or at least get up a good contest, that's like a mark of a good center, because there's some fives who get switched onto ones and it's like, okay, you're immediately going to fall over and you're about to be on, you know, ankle-breaking mixtapes, and you're going to get made look terrible, or Harden's going to pull up and get himself a wide-open three-pointer and you're not, you know, you're going to be stumbling around unable to contest, right? So it's like, if I feel like when most people say he could switch 1 to 5, it's like a base level of competence on that. But what you're really saying is this guy could switch basically onto any player and just guard that guy for stretches of the game.
Right. It's basically who can switch 1 through 5 without embarrassing themselves is how I kind of put it. It's like Draymond Green can switch 1 through 5 and hold his own for 8 seconds in a possession with just about anyone. That's his skill and his ability. And Bam is like, they weren't asking him to like switch whenever, switch onto Westbrook. They were just putting him on him, telling him to, you know, fight under screens, stick with this guy, keep him from getting to the basket, keep him, you know, in the half court, prevent him from attacking in transition. It's like the ask was extraordinary by Spoelstra. And as you said, you know, Westbrook finished with like 27, 8, and 9 or something, like a pretty good game. And the Heat ended up losing by 9 points, I believe. But if you just watch the film, like Bam did a phenomenal job. He bottled Westbrook up. Westbrook usually drives about 18 times a game. In that game, it was 9 or 10, I believe. It was just, you know, he forced the long two pull-ups that you want out of Westbrook. And Westbrook would size him up, think about trying to drive by, realize he couldn't, and pull up. And a lot of them just happened to go in. And that's kind of the percentages and what you do as an NBA defender. There's no stopping. As Bam said, you know, he wasn't expecting to, you know, shut Russell Westbrook down. No one is going to erase him from a basketball game, but you want to make it as difficult as possible. And he did a tremendous job.
What was interesting to me about this is, going back a couple weeks when we were discussing the doubles that Harden was getting, and I think I basically said you can't live or die on Westbrook being the outlet release valve shooter, right? You have to either find other different ways to use him or almost treat him like a big on offense. And I think what we actually saw from Houston in you know some of their adjustments was basically Westbrook kind of flashing towards, you know, the free throw line, taking the pass there, and then using it, basically attacking from there, right? Just like a couple dribbles into the defense. Now he can set up some drive and kick things. It was almost like Draymond-esque, you know, kind of facilitating from the high post, or almost like a big man would, you know, act as, you know, a pick and roll release valve, even though there was actually no screen being set. So it's a fascinating situation that Miami, on the flip side here, is saying, okay, you know, if Westbrook's got some skills now that even though he's a point guard, like he could be being used at certain times because he's a non-shooter like a big, we could just use a big on Westbrook and he's, you know, nimble and agile enough to handle it, even though he's, you know, significantly taller and probably not quite as nimble as a guy like Westbrook is. I think what we're seeing from both sides of this, and this is just kind of a coincidental pairing, but there are two good examples of it. Are we getting to a situation where like modern basketball is defined less by height, you know, strict positions, and more by skill sets? Like, what are you able to do? What can, you know, you do against basically any opponent? How are you contributing efficiently on offense, and who are you able to guard defensively? Like, I think that if you have situations where a center is guarding a point guard for stretches of a game, it's indicative of something that we could be seeing a lot more here going forward, where you're getting cross matchups based on physical attributes like height or maybe weight, but they're not actually cross matchups when it's based on skill set. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I think, I forget when Dwayne Casey said this, but he basically said your position in today's NBA is who you can defend. And I thought that really summed it up really well. And if you look at Bam, he can guard everyone. So I don't know what his position is. And the Miami Heat, when they look at him, they do not see a position. They see this humongous, fast guy who can turn a basketball court into his own personal bouncy castle, which is just a terrific metaphor that I'm surprised my editors allowed me to keep in my story if you want to continue to read it.
So that's what he could do defensively. Now, offensively, you got into the expansion of his playmaking. You did make the Capella comparison and also basically saying, look, this guy can dunk and, you know, the putback stuff and lob threats. He, you know, he's that type of offensive player, but he's trying to expand outside of that. What's his ceiling, do you think, on offense? Because, you know, even a guy like Draymond Green had trouble getting the star reputation there for quite a while because he wasn't scoring in high volume. Like, do you think Bam will be subjected to maybe some of those same slights as he goes forward here in his development? Or are we going to be talking about this guy in the not too distant future as a legit star, period, and everyone's going to agree about it?
What's so interesting about Bam is that when I first decided to write about him, it was, you know, it was a few weeks ago. And so I'm going back through earlier this season, I'm going back to games from late last season when he was inserted into the starting lineup. And it's like from week to week almost, you see different aspects of his game get implemented into an actual 48-minute basketball game where it's like, okay, he's clearly working on these things in practice and he suddenly has enough confidence to put them on display. And it goes back to, you know, when he was growing up, and from AAU to high school to college, it was just kind of a situational thing where he had guard skills that he thought could develop into something special for years. And, you know, his coaches, it's not really fair to say his coaches were holding him back per se, but what the teams needed out of him were not, you know, him to be traffic copping from the high post and, you know, racking up all these assists. Like, they needed him to score, they needed him to rebound, they needed him to do big man things. And right now, just because of how the Miami Heat are structured and how the Miami Heat are built and how they are, you know, they're impervious to outside thought, I think they're one of the more creative organizations in the league. They don't care what anyone thinks about them. And so they're just letting Bam go. And it's awesome to see. And I think on almost a game-by-game basis, you'll see something new out of him, whether it be him creating his own shot, putting it on the deck. He had a crossover dribble past Grant Williams against the Celtics that I put in my story that was, it was like, where did this come from? Like, you don't see, even in watching, I don't want to continue to compare him to Draymond, but when you watch Draymond, you know what you're really getting out of Draymond. Like, when you watch Bam, you have no idea what's going to happen, and he's, like, infinitely more athletic than Draymond ever will be. So I have no idea what his ceiling is. Eric Spoelstra told me that his ceiling, you know, they try not to put a ceiling on him. They don't want to do anything like that because, you know, that just cheats him and it cheats them. And he's, you know, I think he's going to be an all-star. I think that you look across the Eastern Conference, there's only one center, in my opinion, who I would without a doubt take over Bam Adebayo if I was starting a basketball team right now, and that's Joel Embiid. So I think the future is just, it's ridiculous for him. I think he can be a perennial all-star. I think he can win Defensive Player of the Year. I don't know what the ceiling is on this guy.
Did anybody ever comp him to AD? Like, you know, without maybe the offensive polish and the shooting touch quite the same way, but
no,
the rest of the skills, did anybody you talk to bring that one up? Because as you're describing what, you know, he could become, a lot of what I see is what I've hoped for Jaren Jackson Jr., you know, and I've called him Jaren as if, you know, we're family members because I still remain invested in his ability to develop into a big-time mm-hmm. player. But a lot of the blueprint that you're describing for Bam is stuff that I want to see from Jaren, and or we've seen in flashes from Jaren, and he always gets comp to AD.
Yeah, no, for sure. No one actually brought AD's name up in comparisons when I would, you know, ask that question to a lot of people, and Goran Dragic is the only guy who's actually said Draymond. Everyone else said I can't think of any player who is like Bam. So no one actually specifically.
Yeah. That's such an annoying trend. Nobody wants to do the comps.
I love the comps.
Everyone's afraid to put the comps. We need to do the comps as media members, but I'm saying, like, when you interview people, everyone's like, oh, yeah, he's a one of a kind. He's unique, you know. He's a unicorn. I've never seen anything like it. Just go ahead and say who he reminds you of. It's not that big of a deal. It's not like you're labeling him forever. It's tricky because Anthony Davis is such a polished mm-hmm. scorer and has such a nice shooting touch and always did that, you know, for a player who kind of came up with this reputation as an energy guy, they do feel like they're in two different categories. But if you're looking at the defensive impact, the length, the vertical explosiveness, which you're describing, which is definitely superior to Draymond's, you're looking at, you know, some of the playmaking. I mean, Anthony Davis certainly tries to do that. You know, Bam does need to refine that. You know, some of the turnovers, he borders on overly ambitious pretty regularly. So I do think he needs to scale some of that back. But even the ball handling stuff, which he wants to get into every once in a while, is kind of Anthony Davis-esque. It's another trend I think we're going to see here going forward, and I've mentioned it before. You know, fours and fives are going to be allowed to do the kind of stuff that only DeMarcus Cousins did a couple of years ago, right? Where it used to be crazy when he would take off on these jaunts, you know, grab the defensive rebound and go, and it's like everyone's just kind of holding on for dear life as he weaves through traffic, and maybe it's probably going to end in a charge, but you just don't know exactly how. I think we're going to be seeing more and more of that as we go forward, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years of the NBA, of just big guys, you know, being totally empowered to do that stuff. And we're seeing it from Anthony Davis and Towns and Bam as well. So his emergence is a very big deal because for Miami, they were kind of stuck without franchise guys last year, right? It's like, what do they do after Dwayne Wade? They get Jimmy Butler, so he's kind of in place. Bam is rising to an all-star level. You made a pretty compelling case that he could get onto this year's team just because there aren't a ton of bigs in the Eastern Conference outside of the projected starters. I mean, I think a guy like Domantas Sabonis has a chance to be an all-star too this year just because there aren't that many front court players behind Giannis, Pascal, and Joel Embiid. So what does this mean for Miami and for Pat Riley from a team-building perspective? Like, if you were in their seat, are you interested in trying to be aggressive, package together some of these contracts and these players, some of the extra depth, and go out and target another star player? Because if you do that, you could talk yourself into having a big three of Jimmy, Bam, and whoever this other star might be.
I'm a little hesitant to make trade. If I'm Miami, I'm patient. Like, as good as they've been this season, and, you know, there is definitely a call for or an understanding for why they would want to go for it this year. You know, Jimmy's not getting any younger. He's under contract, but he's not getting any younger. The East is, it's not necessarily wide open, but they have as good a shot as anyone to match up, I think, pretty well with the Milwaukees and the Sixers and the Celtics and whoever else is at the top of the East by the end of the season. But when I look at Miami, I'm kind of like, you know, I think free agency, honestly, it's tough if you're a Miami Heat fan, you don't want to hear this, but I think they're a free agency destination, and I think that they should be super patient and wait until the summer of 2021 when all these different stars are available. You know, that's basically their last. They'll have max cap room with Jimmy. It's the year before. There's like a little bit of space and time where they can, you know, fit another max player in before they have to pay Bam Adebayo. You have, you know, Tyler Hero. You have Justice Winslow on a really good deal. So if they were to make a trade, you know, I would want it to be on a very short-term contract. Maybe someone like Danilo Gallinari makes a lot of sense for them. But I don't think someone like Gallo puts them over the top. And I also don't want to give up. I don't want to give up Justice Winslow in a deal like that either. So if I'm them, I'm just kind of like sitting tight and I'm appreciating what's going on. You know, they're getting a lot of production out of low-cost guys like Hero, like Kendrick Nunn, like Bam. So I'm just kind of rolling with it. It's good vibes. They have low expectations. And then in the summer of 2021, when a lot of these like super duper stars become available, I think that's when you pounce.
Yeah, the tricky part with that plan though is, does Jimmy decline by that point, right? I mean, if you get to 2021, are you really looking for almost like a Jimmy replacement, or are you ready to shift him to a secondary role? I do think that they're tied to his clock a little bit because, I mean, he's playing, what would you say, like a top 10, 15 player this year so far?
Undoubtedly.
So, I mean, you're on his clock, right? And he's going to want to win, and he hasn't really had that opportunity. So I'm sure in his mindset, he's thinking, like, let's go out there and do whatever we can do. One guy who disagrees with the patient approach, Michael, is Open Floor Globe member Thaddeus. And he emailed us openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. And Thaddeus writes, "The Heat are long, crazy athletic, and deep. They're too deep. Honestly, it's only worked thus far because they basically always have two players injured. Why don't they try to make a trade to consolidate some of this roster depth into a star? What about if they traded for Kevin Love from the Cleveland Cavaliers for a 2025 top 10 protected first-round pick, James Johnson, Kelly Olynyk, and Derek Jones Jr.? I understand the Heat wouldn't necessarily want to trade another draft pick because they've already traded some, but half measures are how you end up with full disappointment. They would get out of James Johnson and Kelly Olynyk's salary for next year, which is almost identical to Love's anyway. Plus, Olynyk on the Cavs still provides a floor-spacing big to help their younger guards on offense, and maybe you could flip him for some second-rounders down the road. A Heat rotation with Bam, Kevin Love, Justice Winslow, Robinson and Jimmy Butler starting, and having Dragic, Hero, Nunn, and Leonard coming off the bench would be super scary. They'd still have some contracts in there to make another move if they desired as well." So the downside here would be that you're taking on Kevin Love's, you know, future money, and it's pretty significant, and he's after 30. he's been pretty checked out this season. He hasn't put up big numbers, and he's just kind of waiting on whatever his next move would be. The upside is, as he mentions, you would have a starting lineup that would maybe be comparable to anybody's in the Eastern Conference, and you would give yourself a chance, a real chance, for Eastern Conference finals and finals. What do you make of Thaddeus' proposal, Michael? Would you pull the trigger?
Well, I would not, just because of what I said about 2021. I think, I don't think Kevin Love is...
So Love's not the right guy. He's not good enough, not enough, high enough ceiling if you're Miami to get you interested?
I don't think so, no. As you said, the age, he has a lot of health problems also in his past. He's been okay this year for the most part, but I would worry about that. I mean, he's owed over $60 million over the next 3 years. That's tough. I think that given, I understand what you're saying about, Jimmy has you on the clock, but... I still think that you slow roll it. He is under contract for, this year, next year, the year after that, and then there's the player option. So it does you can make it work, and I understand that patience is really difficult, particularly in today's league, where who knows what the hell is going to happen in 6 months, let alone, a year and a half from now. My other problem with this deal is that, I don't think the Cavs would ever in a million years do it. If Justice Winslow is not a part of this package, they're hanging up the phone.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see what Kevin Love's trade value looks like, because I think, the contract is big. I could easily see him picking up that player option year. So now you're looking at basically $90 million mm-hmm. over three future years, just based on where his age is at this point. And to me, the tricky thing is, if Love could really play center and make it work defensively in playoff situations, then if I trusted that, I would be more inclined to trade for him. But I feel the same way, if I'm the Portland Trailblazers, some of these other teams that have been linked to Kevin Love, he presents some lineup issues, right? For a long time, he was very helpful as that stretch four player who could also give you some rebounding and some passing from the high post. He creates spacing, but... to me, if he's your four, he's not the quickest guy anymore. He never was. So that could be a tough matchup on certain nights. He's not really pounding the glass like he used to earlier in his career. So he's not punishing smaller fours necessarily like he once was. And maybe some of this comes back with a change of scenery, because now he has, more investment, better teammates to play with. I almost view him as he's aging, as he's a more natural fit as a five, where now he's a stretch five, so he gives you more value with the shooting there. But he never has really played that role defensively that well and sustained it. And so I kind of come back to if you have Bam in place, how good is that pairing? Bam and Love, really? Does Love kind of hold it back a little bit? And would you rather just be more athletic and more versatile in that four spot, as opposed to trying to roll with Kevin Love? So I don't know. I guess I say no to this trade mostly because of Kevin Love as the contract, but then secondarily because of Kevin Love the player.
Yeah, all that's really fair. I will just say that I think that Kevin Love as a defender, if you look at how those Cavs teams performed defensively with him on the floor, up until they had to play Steph Curry and Klay Thompson and the most impossible offense ever, they were pretty good with Love on the court. So I think his defense is unfairly criticized because of what everyone saw on the biggest stage. But to your point, he's getting older, he's getting slower, and there's only it's not like he's super flexible. It's not like he's a rim protector who you can just kind of have drop coverage against pick and rolls. So I think it ultimately hurts you a little bit. And what Kelly Olynyk, you have to just ask yourself if the cost really justifies the cost difference in the contract between Kelly Olynyk and Kevin Love justifies making a move like that, because what Kelly gives you is basically the same thing offensively for the most part for the role that they want on that team. So I just think there's a lot of problems here, and if I was Miami, I don't think I would do it if I was either team, to be honest.
I love it. Hey, it's not necessarily so much that he couldn't he wasn't a good defender in his prime, right? I just think he's definitely post-prime when it comes to Kevin Love on that end. And I also think, like, so the teams that they would have to face in this year's playoffs or next year's playoffs in the East would real he would struggle. Like, if Giannis is barreling down at him and they're in a, you know, quote-unquote small ball lineup with Kevin Love at the five, I do not feel good about that. You know, that sounds to me like a poster party for Giannis. And then if you're trying to match up with Joel Embiid with Kevin Love, I'm not loving that one either. How do you feel on those two?
First of all, what is a poster party? Is that just, are you, is everyone hanging out? They got the scotch tape. They're unrolling the posters. There's an open giant wall. We're putting up the posters. Is that what a poster party is?
Basically, all the Giannis Inc. board assembles, and we get those photography bib vests, and we sit underneath, you know, along the baseline, underneath the hoop, all of us with our iPhones in slow-mo mode, just waiting to capture frame by frame Giannis dunking on Kevin Love's head, possession after possession after possession. Once that's done, we retreat to the photo room. We compare who got the best angle. We blow up the posters. We hand them out. To me, that's a poster party.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify. No, I agree with your greater point here that you go up against a team like the Bucks and they go small with Giannis at the five and they're spacing you out. And I don't really know what Kevin Love does on those possessions defensively. So I think we're on the same page here.
All right. We have floated this idea that Bam is a first-time All-Star candidate. I mentioned DeMontis Sabonis earlier as a potential candidate from the Indiana Pacers. He's got good numbers, great efficiency. They've been winning. It's kind of crazy. Like, his dad is one of the greatest basketball players of all time, never to make an NBA All-Star game just because he came over so late. So it'd be kind of cool, actually, if Sabonis got in there. I think he might have to compete with like a guy like Brogdon, like one of his teammates, you know, to be the Pacers representative, but it could just be an easier path for him. When you're looking around here, you know, in this early going, of course, Luka, of course, Pascal are going to make it as first-time All-Stars this year. But if you go back over the last 20 years, only an average of six guys are first-time All-Stars each year. So it's a pretty exclusive club to crack. And obviously the popularity contest aspect of voting makes it more difficult. I guess, who do you think are the most likely candidates to be able to get in this year? And do you agree with my premise that because we have injuries to Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and Victor Oladipo, there could actually be more new faces than we usually see at the 2020 All-Star game?
Right. I'm excited. This could be fun. I do have a couple names here. Also, Kyrie Irving has been hurt, and I don't know if he'll make it. I know he's super popular.
Well,
yeah,
you know how it's going to work, right? Spencer Dinwiddie's going to earn the spot, and then Kyrie's going to take it, and it's going to be just a perfect representation of the Brooklyn Nets.
Well, I guess, do you want to just start with, Spencer's on my list here. You know, I'm in Brooklyn and have seen him play a ton in person. He's been just super impressive, especially in crunch time of tight games. Like, he's like a legit lead ball handler on a good offense. He runs pick and roll. He really knows how to draw fouls. He finishes at the rim. Like, he's the center of every opposing scouting report, and he's still getting it done. So I think he's been a monster. You know, if he could actually hit threes, which low-key he has not really been able to do as an NBA player, I think he would be a shoo-in for the All-Star team. So that's like my first guy. What are your thoughts about Spencer off the bat?
I think he's in the mix. It's going to be tough for those East guard spots, though. You know, I think that's always, you know, you've got a lot of returning guys. I do think Kyrie will, if he comes back and with the big scoring number and the fan vote and his popularity, quote unquote, among, you know, just, you know, name recognition among fellow players, I think that he's going to just take Spencer's spot and Spencer will be an afterthought, and I feel bad for him. But there's some other interesting guards like in that mix. I mentioned Brogdon, who's never made it, but Van Vliet, doesn't he deserve a look too?
Mm-hmm.
So already we're looking at kind of like a new wave of East guards that could crash the party. But I think, you know, among those backcourt players, that's probably how you're going to classify him. What about Jaylen Brown? I mean, shouldn't he be viewed as kind of a top candidate there too?
Oh, I mean, he's basically an MVP candidate. No, I mean, I thought we were saving it for that part of the conversation.
Ooh,
no, spicy. No, Jaylen's been Jalen's taken the leap. I mean, I think it was really funny when he signed that contract extension and there was a debate about whether or not the Celtics overpaid. And now, I mean, it's like objectively a bargain for them. Well, it's a lot of money, so I don't want to say it's a bargain, but they don't have to pay the max. So that's wonderful. I think Jalen and Jason Tatum are both kind of, they'll potentially need to battle it out. I think one of them will get in. I'm not guaranteeing that two will, because I think Kemba's a lock, and I don't know if the Celtics are deserving of three All-Stars. So one of those two is going to make it. I
kind of think both are getting in, man. I got to say, as much as it pains me, you know, I'm not drinking the green beer, but if they're still in this position, like, you know, top three seed, as we get closer, when you look at Tatum, I mean, I just feel like kind of like the league intelligentsia has kind of been waiting to crown him as like this future wing, you know, the wing of the future. There are going to be some front court spots, so you can slot him into one of those like reserve front court spots. The Celtics are kind of this prestige, you know, big market, often discussed franchise. And so if it comes down to like him versus a player like a Tobias Harris, you know, or someone else, I feel like he would maybe get the benefit of the doubt. And also, like, you know, from the coach's standpoint, I think both Brown and Tatum, it's like there's no red flags, there's no knocks there, you know what I mean? Like, they play the right way, quote unquote, they play hard, so, you know, they're good citizens. Yeah. Off the court, I think all those things are effective tiebreakers a lot of times.
So you're not really on the Davis Bertans bandwagon? You don't think he's going to take one of their spots?
Well, I was already penciling him to start. I think he's going to start. You know, I think a lot of these guys are going to be reserve candidates. No, Davis is crazy, man. Like, that's a whole side story. Did you really have him as one of your all-star candidates?
I wrote him down, like, as a joke candidate, and then I was, like, doing a little – I got lost in a rabbit hole in his basketball reference page, and, like – it's absurd. I mean, he's taking like 8 catch and shoot threes a game and making like 47% of them. It's like, what is even happening? The Spurs just must be like
the other night
banging their head. Yeah,
the other night he was playing Papa Shot, man. He was pulled up from 45 feet, like one step inside the half court line. But you were saying like this is payback, or this is a retribution for the Spurs moving on from him.
Yeah, I think the Spurs are probably regretting that one, and I don't really know what happened there with the whole Marcus Morris snafu that probably screwed them over a little bit. But yeah, they definitely wish they had Davis Bertans, who is like second in offensive real plus minus right now, just like a complete stud. The other, I have another guard for you, and I've already brought him up a couple weeks ago in an episode when we were talking about most improved player, but like, why can't Devontae Graham be an all-star this season? I mean,
wow, you're getting really aggressive. You're heat checking here on me right now.
No, I mean, like, I don't know about you, but heading into the season, I thought that the Charlotte Hornets would be the worst team in the NBA. And because of Devontae Graham, almost single-handedly, like, I'll watch a Charlotte Hornets game and they're not terrible. Like, they might make the playoffs because of this dude. He's averaging 20-7. He's leading the league in minutes. Like, what is even happening? The Hornets die when he's off the court. He's one of the better three-point shooters in the league so far. I don't know. I mean, if we play the game where we go on preseason expectations, we go on, you know, this team's winning, they need a representative. I Devontae is... he's deserving.
I hear you. He deserves to be in this conversation. I also think that he's like a perfect candidate to be snubbed, right? Like, the basketball dorks are on him, like you. No offense, but I think you qualify as a basketball dork. I just have a hard time believing that like the coaches are going to be like, all right, we're going to put him in over, you know, a bigger name or a more established player. Because I do think there's like usually a year delay on this stuff, right? Like, if he continues to play like this for 18 months, I could see him getting in next year. But I think the coaches are wary of like putting guys in based off of a, you know, a hot 4 month stretch. So I don't know, but I love that you're basically his fan club now. That's you're in early.
I'm all
no
in.
Doubt.
I'm all
hey,
in.
What about like, here's a good comparison. Like, don't you think Trey would get in before him?
I was literally about to ask you if I had in one hand Trae Young and in the other hand Devontae Graham. you know, which one would you pick? And that's not an insult because they're small people. I can't actually hold them in my hands. But for the purpose of this exercise, pretend I can. Like, who do you think is more deserving? Because Trae Young's situation is like, I'm now at the point where I just want to watch whatever team is playing the Atlanta Hawks because I feel like history will be made. Like, that's how bad that team is right now, particularly on defense, particularly because of Trae Young's defense. So, I mean, I said a lot of really nice things on him about him in our last episode, and I stand by them. I think offensively he's been terrific, absolute flamethrower. But that team's just really, really bad. And if you look at Devontae Graham, who, you know, similar supporting cast, probably a little better, but... You know, the Hornets are not a complete train wreck at all times. And, you know, when he's on the floor, their offense is actually pretty decent. So who do you think is more deserving, I should say, between Trae and Devontae given those situations?
I would still say Trae just because I'm willing to excuse basically everything around him as not his fault. And because I think that he ultimately commands more attention if you gave them equal supporting cast, he would get more wins out of it, but I wouldn't guarantee it. And I think it's an interesting conversation, but this goes back to my point. Like, I definitely think the coaches would reward Trae because he had, you know, some progress from last season. He's a bigger name, you know, he's kind of flashier, maybe more marketable than a guy like Graham. And so, like, if I had to predict which one's going to make it, I would definitely think that Trae would make it over Graham.
Okay, I have a guy in the Western Conference now, which is obviously it's really difficult to break in on that side. What about Devin Booker? Like, is this the year he finally makes an All-Star team?
He's on my list too, because in part because some of those spots like Klay Thompson and Kevin Durant are open, right? Steph Curry, there's spots open where he would slot in. To me, and I know he hasn't had his best year necessarily, and Utah's been a little bit up and down, I still think the most deserving first-time All-Star in the West is Rudy Gobert.
Don't do it. You
thought I was going to say Mitchell?
You surprised me.
I was going to say Mitchell, huh?
Yeah.
See, that's why I feel bad for Rudy, man. He's in this perfect storm where he plays center. He's not a big-time scorer. He's not a shooter. He doesn't really get credit for what he's doing. Everyone's going to laugh if he cries again because he doesn't make the team. But if you're looking at overall impact, if you're looking at best players at his position, it's tricky because he's going to be behind Davis. He's going to be behind Towns. He's going to be behind potentially Jokic. But if you're saying who really deserves to be an All-Star, you know, one of the 12 most important players in the Western Conference, to me, it's Rudy Gobert. And then you can get into this discussion of, okay, like Booker versus Mitchell. And I think because Gobert, to me, is still Utah's most important player, I think Mitchell would have to be snubbed, and you'd probably have to give the benefit of the doubt to Booker, making his teammates better, shooting 50, 40, 90s, you know, more efficient, and kind of the number one guy there in Phoenix, where maybe Mitchell isn't like that clear-cut number one guy. So I guess I would, on the pecking order, I would have Booker above Donovan Mitchell. I would have Booker above Jamal Murray. I would have Booker above a CJ McCollum, just based on like Portland's record, you know, Murray being kind of the number two guy in Denver, and Mitchell maybe being the number two guy in Utah. So that's how I would break it down. But I guess if I was voting now, I would say both Gobert and Booker have really good shots of getting in.
That's so funny that I did not even think about Rudy Gobert for this exercise. Like, I think I'm just that far out on the Jazz right now, and every time,
well, and he's been snubbed so many times, it's like you would just assume that he would have made one, but he's never made one. And a lot of these first timers who we're talking about, they're guys who are 22, 23 years old, and that's not Gobert.
No, that's exactly right. He didn't even come up, he wasn't even on my radar. And that's, I mean, no disrespect to Rudy Gobert, who I think is really, you know, he impacts games on the defensive end as much as anyone. He's in position, I think, to win yet another Defensive Player of the Year award. But this, like, it wouldn't feel right if this was the year he made it, just because of how, you know, maybe Utah will right the ship, but, you know, their schedule has been pretty tough. But they just don't look good at all when I watch them. I really don't even enjoy, I don't enjoy watching them play, which I thought I would coming into this season. And I'm not like blaming Rudy for that. If I'm blaming anyone, it's probably Donovan, who that's potentially my own fault because my expectations for him were so high coming in. And I think he looks lost on offensive possessions and his shot selection has been atrocious. But Rudy's an interesting one. I don't know.
Well, so right now there's only six teams in the West that are over 500. I think the Jazz are better than their record, and they're 14-11. So I'm anticipating by the time people have to vote in February, they're going to look a little bit better than they do right now. They might still be in that sixth spot, but they will be above the next tier of teams. So that gets into this conversation of like, do the Jazz need to have a representative kind of based on their team success? And then I could easily see the coaches saying, well, look, Donovan Mitchell is more marketable. He has a higher scoring average. He's got the sneaker deal. People love him. He's got the cute nickname and everything else. And saying, all right, well, we're going to put Donovan Mitchell in over Rudy. My question to you is, so if it happens that Donovan Mitchell makes it and Rudy Gobert doesn't, obviously in public, there will be no tears from Rudy Gobert. There will be a brave face congratulating his teammate. In private, would you cry if that happened?
Oh, I didn't know you were going to go with the cry angle.
I'm just saying, like, deep down, years of snubbing that he took personally and he had to talk to his mother on the phone about it, and he was very upset last year. If he gets snubbed again but Donovan makes it, is he happy or is he upset?
No, I was thinking more like, could it ruffle some feathers behind the scenes? Like,
oh, a schism.
Yeah, and with Rudy's free agency coming up, you know, there's a situation where I believe he's Supermax eligible. And so if they do not offer the Supermax and they offer him just like a straight five-year max or a four-year max or something, if he's like, all right, screw this, I'm out, despite, you know, the organization-wide commitment that you've had to developing me into what I am, I could see that happening if Donovan kind of leapfrogs him as a priority with the organization. I don't know. That's just like me being an idiot speculating. But to answer your initial question, I do think he would cry in private.
Oh. Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. Let's hope he makes it. All right, we got Booker in this conversation. Who else did you have maybe from Western Conference teams who you think could sneak in?
Yeah, I had Donovan. I focused more on the East, to be honest with you. I mean,
well, it's easier.
Yeah.
You know, it's AAA. There's less talent out there, you know.
I mean, someone like, and I don't think he'll make it, but someone like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who's having low-key a pretty good year on a team that I think has surprised some people, maybe he gets his name in the conversation a little bit. His numbers are pretty good. He's hitting threes. He's a really solid defender. He can let Billy Donovan play those three-guard lineups with him, CP, and Dennis Schroeder that have been tearing the league apart. So maybe him, maybe even CP, who...
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the coaches are going to look at OKC and give Chris Paul the career validation selection. You know, put him back in there as long as he stays healthy. And so I think that would box out Shai. What about on the wings? I know you had mentioned last week you think, you know, Brandon Ingram can't kind of get in because of, you know, the Pelicans' kind of poor record and everything. But what about the original Brandon Ingram? What about Andrew Wiggins?
Andrew Wiggins. Wow.
I mean, he's competing with Karl Towns there, you know, of course. So, like, you know, is Minnesota going to be good enough to have two?
No.
They're in a losing streak right now.
The answer is no. They will not. I don't think they will be good enough to get two. Wiggins is a wonderful story. I think this is kind of, it reminds me of what you said about Devontae, where it's like people are just a year too late about these kinds of things. And so if he's able to prove that this is the new him for the rest of this season and then the first half of next season, then we can talk. And Minnesota's winning basketball games. But, I mean, right now they're not in the – I don't think they would make the playoffs if the season ended today, despite their hot start, despite how incredible Karl-Anthony Towns looks. So I would probably say no to Andrew Wiggins.
I think he's going to be on the outside looking in, but it's remarkable that I even said his name in a positive manner. So you know, that's that qualifies as progress. Any other final candidates you want to throw out there?
You know who's having a really good year?
I could wait all day in anticipation. Who?
Will Barton.
Wow.
In Denver.
Yeah.
This goes back to the Portland days with you. This really hits home, I hope. Will Barton has been, you know, he stepped it up on the defensive end. I'm doing a story right now about Denver's defense and continuity and all that. And Will Barton's individual improvement on that side of the ball has been kind of remarkable. You know, last year he had the worst defensive rating on the team. They were terrible when he was on the floor. This year they're never better than when he's on the floor. I don't know. I think that with Jamal Murray not really taking the leap forward offensively, with Jokic kind of loafing in between all NBA brilliance and someone who's just disengaged and doesn't want to be in the NBA, I feel like Will Barton could sneak in to maybe a conversation. He'll never make it, but I just want to throw his name out there.
No, I love it. You know what we should do? Like, Bogdanovich has been in the Rising Stars game, even though he's like 36 years old, the guy from the Kings, you know? Like, he's just been in this Rising Stars game, I swear, for like 4 straight years. Let's just grandfather Will Barton into the Rising Stars game and like have him on the opposite team as Bogdanovich and just let them go back and forth. I think that's probably the way we can settle this, because Barton's not going to make the All-Star team, but he has been a good enough story that we need to honor him in some manner in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, he's shooting 40% from three. I let's put him in there in some form or fashion. I'm sure he would love to make the trip to wintry Chicago and compete in the skills competition as opposed to going on vacation. But but yeah, it would be a tremendous honor for him.
Well, look, Michael, we ran long on these topics. Thanks so much for all the information on Bam Adebayo and for the off-the-wall and outside-the-box selections on All-Stars. You brought a lot of knowledge to the table this week. I appreciate it. We got so many emails that we didn't get to, so we're going to roll those over to next week. Open Floor Globe, keep them coming. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Just as a little teaser, we heard from a lot of people when it came to the debate on team fans versus player fans. We got some great insight from a former Navy officer, you know, other people overseas who are stridently anti-fan bigamy, and they don't want their friends you know, taking on multiple teams as their favorites. So we're going to dig into all that stuff on next week's episode, and I can't wait. Guys, check us out on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find the page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golver, on Twitter at Ben.Golver. Check out my page there to sign up for my Washington Post weekly newsletter. Michael is on both Twitter and Instagram at Michael V as in Victor Pina. Hey, Michael, until next week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.